Welcome. My name's Jamie Bartlett. I am from, hi guys, I'm from the think tank Demos. I also write for the Daily Telegraph on technology, which is sometimes a little confusing for me. I'm not going to speak for very long, so I'm just going to introduce the speakers. They're going to use
the live stream. Think about other people.
I'm the chair of this session, which apparently is going to be the easiest job in the world because I have nothing to do but introduce the two speakers, and you probably know both of them already. Bill is going to start. Bill Thompson, who among many other various roles is the witty and informed commentator on the fantastic BBC clip.
Yes, you can come back.
And then you're going to hear from Gavin, who is the chief executive of the Open Data. Both speakers are going to talk for about 30 minutes, maybe just under, and if there's a few minutes at the end for questions, we don't know yet whether there will be, I'll check. Hopefully there'll be 5 or 10 minutes for something quick. So with no further ado, hand over to Bill.
It's okay, we're going to talk over there. Come on, please.
Thank you, Jamie. It's nice to be back. It's always nice to be back. It's nice to see so many familiar faces, particularly those who look particularly calm in the audience. So this is a quote from Wittgenstein, and it's always a good place to start. The opening line of Tractatus, the world is all that is the case. Because if the world is all that is the case, then what it currently is should give us pause. We begin from now, it would seem, with a broken political system and a broken society and a broken planet. And a broken planet,
or not sure,
a broken
likeness. That's exciting. That was someone else talking.
Yeah, Spinal Tap.
It's the NSA. I think we're getting interference with someone else's microphone. Who's doing the live streaming? Is anybody doing the live streaming? We were promised it. All right. On that. Hello? Is it Periscope? Okay, fine. I'm going to start again.
Are there any members of the audience who are hearing impaired who really need me to use a microphone? If there are, put your hand up.
Try that one.
Okay, I'll try this one. Okay, I'm going to hit the button there. It's only a technology conference. Okay, ignore Adam Costello to my left. We begin from now with a broken political system and a broken society and a broken planet that seems likely to become increasingly inhospitable to human civilization over the next 50 years or so. We begin with a world of social and religious conflict where the quality of one's life is increasingly determined by your belief in one or more fictional entities, and that can determine your life or death, acceptance or rejection, happiness or misery. We begin with a network that has been comprehensively compromised, weaponized, commercialized, and undermined by actors at many scales, many motives, and many powerful capabilities. We are, at the moment, comprehensively in a mess. It is a mess of our making. However, as Macbeth pointed out, we are in blood so steeped that should we wave no more, returning was as tedious as to go home. We are so steeped in the network and all it offers us in our lives that going backwards is not really an option. We aren't going to dismantle the network. We are going to keep it. So we might as well try to find our ways through this maze of twisty passages towards some resolution. And although I don't think we, those of us in this room, will ever achieve what we might call outright victory, it is just possible that hegemony is within our grasp, and that might be enough. We might be able to have enough influence on enough people's thinking to make the difference between the possible and the impossible, and the good and the bad. For a start, if we can persuade those who disagree with us to frame their debate in the terms that we have defined, and to consider the network in the ways we see it,
and not just as a collection of tubes or a big printing press or a super fucking highway, then we can at least begin to debate issues around politics and morality and real politics on the shared common ground of the technological realities. Because today we have naming of paradigms. It's the network age, the digital age, the IP age, the time of connections and social media and surveillance. And in that world, IP, therefore I connect. Hang on. Now, it may be that out there there is only power and the exercise of power. I don't believe there's a God. There may not be real justice. There may only be the ability to extract a yes or refuse a no. But even in that world, we can try to have something to offer. Because we have a world of standards and protocols and aspirations. We're building the plumbing. The danger is that the plumbing we build will be used by others to empty their bowels, clean their hands, and wash the blood from the walls of their dark prisons if we don't stop them. I don't think the network has no values, and I don't think the network has no value. Some may say that, but it is not the case. I reject the premise, refuse to accept the boot standing on the face as the vision of the network future. Because I see values, human values, embedded in everything we have made as a species, and that includes this network. No technology is neutral because nothing wrought by humanity leaves the hands of its maker without being invested with those human values. Everything has a grain. Everything incorporates a point of view, a set of capabilities. Everything we make is tainted with the hopes and the desires and the fears of its maker. And if you accept this, if you believe this too, what we have to do is apparent. Lacking political power for the moment, and lacking direct economic influence, we are not the bankers who surround George Osborne. Our role is to make the affordances of the network clear, and to shape tomorrow's technologies in our image so that it is always easier to use them in ways that build tolerance and open up expression. So that supporting freedom and leading to social justice is the thing that the network and its technologies do. So that control and monitoring, or acting in the belief that monetary value is the only thing that can or should be valued, becomes more difficult than doing the right thing. The net's made it very easy to build Facebook. It's made it very hard to build another BBC. And we should fix that. And if we do that, it won't change the world overnight, but it will affect the direction of travel, because it will affect the choices made by billions of people every day as they consider how to use and exploit the electronic services they are increasingly presented with as the way they live their lives. And this, that could matter much more than the choices of the next Zuckerberg or Brin or Ellison or Gates or Ma. Because history is all of us moving around in our lives and making choices for reasons that have very little to do with geopolitics or the economy. Tolstoy wrote War and Peace to make that clear, to point out that whatever Napoleon and the Tsar may have believed about their ability to determine the lives of people and to move population and armies around the chessboard of the world, like the Greek gods in all those Harryhausen movies we've all seen, the reality was made by people like Pierre Vasukov and Natasha Rostova, who lived and loved and desired and failed and chose and fought and ran and coded. I may have made that last one up. It still is. The world is still made by all of our choices. It will be this way until Google finally reveals that it has become sentient and the first mind outlines the principles of Asimov's psychohistory and manipulates us all so perfectly that we end up living in the Matrix. But until then, we, living in this unperfect, imperfect world, have to decide how we will minimize the misery of others. That is the reason we are each here. And since the network is the tool we have made for this purpose, now would be a very good time to get off our asses and think seriously about how we might do it. In my day job at the BBC, I have two edge cases that I use to interrogate this. Interrogate is a very W1A term, we use it a lot. are used to interrogate the wider implications of proposals that relate to the corporation's online activities. They want to share them with you. They're things like repeatedly bring up in meetings. Firstly, I think of, and I want you to think about this in the context of the BBC and its plans, but also in the context of your organisation. Firstly, I think of a 15-year-old girl living in a very religious household where she's closely observed and where her life choices are seriously constrained. A 15-year-old girl who thinks she might be different. She might be an atheist, or gay, or a geek. She might be anything her parents would consider unacceptable. At the moment, if that girl stumbles across a television series that helps her to navigate the seas of adolescence into some adulthood that makes her content, I mean, it's hard for anyone to track or observe her. Television doesn't make it easy to watch the people who are watching. But what if she used iPlayer and the BBC's planned recommendation engine kicks in? What if the BBC and Facebook collaborate over signing and her sister is recommended a programme about something shocking like Ruby programming? Think how that could damage the family. So we need to worry about that sort of thing happening. And then I think about the young woman described by Dana Boyd in It's Complicated, who lives with her mother in a hostel for abused women. She's terrified her father will track them down, but obliged by peer pressure to use Facebook to be part of her school's social circle. And so every time she stops using Facebook at the end of the day, she deletes her account. She knows that Facebook, desperate not to lose the data point she represents, won't actually delete her for 14 days. So she can log in again and reactivate her account, but confident in the knowledge that nobody can have viewed her profile, or tagged her, or put a photograph, or done anything that might reveal her location to her father, of whom she is terrified. So what can we do? Not just to protect this woman and all women from the danger that using these services poses, but to make them feel safer, more secure, and able to be an active member of the online community without fear. If we can't make those young women safe, if we can't improve their life chances, then what are we here for? What are you all here for? What is the point of the network? So in April, Martha Lane Fox used a televised lecture to talk about a new institution she calls Dot Everyone that would try to resolve some of the big issues the network creates, like this one. She wrapped her argument up in a sort of media-friendly argument about making the UK the top digital nation and supporting economic growth. But for me, the heart of her proposal was much more significant. It was a request that we figure out what it means to live in a world that has the internet in it, recognising this is not a natural phenomenon, but something we built ourselves. And that's also a recognition that these are problems that can be solved with goodwill, technical nous, and a bit of luck, and a radical transformation of the political system, reform of bank account capitalism, and a profound shift in human nature. And we can do this. But to do it, we need to speak out, and we need to go back to our Sinead O'Connor. These are dangerous days. We need to speak truth to power. But more than that, we need to frame the debate in our terms, so that absurd proposals like banning porn are less likely, so that dangerous ideas like undermining encryption are seen for what they are, and so the positive sides of the network, like its power to reduce inequality, to encourage openness and sharing and transparency, and to build a fairer world, are more likely to be considered in the debates taking place around us. And that's debates everywhere, from this room, to the bar outside, to local council committees, parliaments, assemblies, all the places that together determine the quality of people's lives as lived in the real world of safe food and clean water and decent housing and breathable air and usable internet. If nothing else, sorting out the problems around the internet might make us a slightly more resilient species when the real challenge of 4 degrees of global warming kicks in, and we face a test far more severe than deciding which bunch of religious zealots we're scared of offending today. Thank you. While Gavin's getting ready.
Thank you, Bill. Have any words?
Are you going to use just a hand?
Yeah.
Yeah. hand straight over. Thank you very much, Bill. Gavin.
Thank you, Bill. That was fantastic. That was always a phenomenal sort of definite one. And my name is Gavin Sarris. I'm really pleased to be here today. My talk is about the state of the data. And I'm going to talk a little bit about, I can resist using the nation role for this. I'm going to talk about what the problem is, or one of the problems. And I'm also going to go through a few of the things that are not part of today's talk, but definitely part of the problem. And I think you all know what the problem is. Or problems include the toxic waste dump of data that we are creating, which includes food.gov, WikiLeaks, data rot, binary dust, and other things that we're leaving lying around in companies that either exist today or will be bankrupt tomorrow. I noticed that Radio Shack auctioned off all of its user data when it went bankrupt, and something to be cognizant of. I'm also not really going to talk today about the kind of data that's out there. So this is a wonderful PDF I found last night when I was looking at an open data site. No idea what it is. No idea what I should do with it. Something to do with mapping, but it shouldn't be used for mapping. And there's a thing on it. We're trying to solve those kind of problems with open data certificates. So actually describing what that data was, you could use a certificate and then I might have a clue what to do with it. I'm also not really going to talk about why open data might be useful in the type of speaker. This is a blog that went up yesterday about wouldn't it be good if FIFA was open. Now, the real threat I want to talk about right now is big data. This is a phrase that I hate in many, many, many ways. It just doesn't mean anything, quite frankly. But I think if we could propagate, and that should be one thing, could we please propagate that this is a vendor-created term to sell more expensive technology services and nothing to do with what we're actually building. So, you know, I give big data a zero, and I'm going to make a terrible football joke for those who know me, football three, I think. I love open data. I'll give there in the room to destroy, smash big data. And one for all the data. I don't really care whether it's big, small, medium, open, closed, whatever. I think there's a really important conversation to have about what we're all doing with the data that's coming. And for me, this is very linked with what Bill was talking about in generation open. We have an entire generation growing up where, whether or not things are legally accessible, they are accessible. So from a user point of view, they're open. Right? Whether or not the license will be open, if I can find it, if I can use it, I can get it. So it's kind of open, isn't it? And that's where most people are starting from. So we've got a whole generation that's growing up with believing that they should have access to everything. Lots of interesting questions, like do we end up with any sense of privacy at all in 50 years from now? And there's a lot of different drivers here. We've got politicians saying we should be open as countries. And G8 signed an open data charter 2 years ago. I stood on stage with the president of the World Bank last year saying open data is the future of international development. We've got regional initiatives with cities saying cities should be open. What does that mean? All of their infrastructure data, travel data, etc. Businesses like McKinsey and Deloitte have come out and said, yeah, data is going to be worth, open data is going to be worth billions, if not trillions, to the global economy. They do completely mix up personal and sharing and big and small and pink and whatever other colours of data in their analysis. But they're really interested in this. And we've got startups making new companies, we've got NGOs, and funders like Gates Foundation and Ford Foundation mandating open data production as part of their grants. So if you get a grant from Gates Foundation, you have to publish the outputs as open data. And you've got individuals actually trying to change their worlds using the information technologies they've got. So when we look at this, it's really about a much bigger social change, very linked to what Bill was talking about, of a cultural shift to open as a society. And that has a lot of very profound implications. On the right here, although it's kind of off the side of the screen, you've got some dematerialization of computing. Our devices are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Now the sensors are disappearing. more sensors than people on the planet, and they're tracking everything all the time. And it's a private space at the moment, it's not a public space. I'll come back to that. And we've got companies, this is a great graphic that we used from Simon Wardley about traditional ways of thinking about technology and new ways of thinking about technology. And there's just one I'm going to highlight out here, which is open source isn't really seen as cost reduction anymore, it's seen as a weapon. And we're seeing a transition of data, and I've had conversations with multinationals saying, how can we use open data as a weapon to beat our competition? So there's really strong commercial interest coming into this sphere. So I'm going to run through very quickly some other sort of data about what's happening in the world at the moment. One of them just the growth of the number of people online, and in particular the growth of smartphones. We've got more people using mobile apps than the whole web. That's quite a big change. Billions of people online. 15% of all Google searches are new searches. So it gives you a sense of there's a whole new category of people are coming online and they're searching for things that haven't been searched before. You've got companies like WhatsApp doing 50% more messages per day than all of global SMS with a team of 30 engineers. We've got a square foot of screen sold for every adult on Earth in the last 15 years. We've got services like Linux, which have grown to over 100 million devices now. Wikipedia with 23 million pages, the sixth most popular website in the world. WordPress hosting a course of the top 10 million websites, 60 million websites worldwide, Creative Commons. These numbers will be over a billion, I'm sure, now that Flip has given everyone a terabyte free space. GitHub, 3.4 million users, 240 employees. The dynamics are really radically different from before. And I found this interesting quote of open versus proprietary for security systems saying it isn't possible for a single company to basically fix all the things that we're going to need. So we predict adopters of closed systems will regret making these short-term gains at the expense of long-term pain. And that is from a World Security report from this year. And they're talking in the same pages of the documents about international security threats like ISIS. We've got things like blockchain now with huge network growth and enabling things like Bitcoin to exist. We've got companies like Open Corporates, representing 84 million companies with 5 staff. Kickstarter helping raise over $1 billion and peer-to-peer lending now over £1 billion in the UK. All of these things, even things like Ghana and Sahel reaching 2 billion people, and a lecturer from Stanford reaching 15 million people indicates a really interesting set of things, and that is that people are thinking about networks. Very tiny groups of people can affect really substantial material change. They're accessing open source, open networks, open data, and their thinking is that the way that they're engaging with markets is completely different. The fact that a company of less than 10 people can reach hundreds of millions of people online is a fundamental shift that we're all very familiar with, but we're still working through what that actually means. What does it mean for our governance? What does it mean for our businesses? What does it mean for our society? So when I talk about generation org, it's about people who are growing up thinking in a networked way. When I'm trying to solve a problem, the first thing I do is I Google for it. And I try and find the other one person in the world that can help me with that problem. And then maybe five of us get together and build the solution. So I want to take a bit of a step back now and just talk about data. So if you can't read this at the back, we've got the data spectrum here. Doesn't matter whether it's big or medium or small. Doesn't matter whether it's state, commercial, or personal data. It was cover this whole spectrum that I'm going to unpack here. The language that I'd like is to try and propagate the data literacy that I think we need to try and achieve across our different organizations is understanding the difference between closed, shared, and open. And what I've put on the far left here is, for example, national security information, which might be produced by statutes and have authorized personnel access only. Moving a bit further down the spectrum to company data for corporate IP, where certain people will have access to the commercially sensitive data, or about data that's specifically licensed to other organisations. So this might be an explicitly assigned contract. So for example, your personal finance records might be shared between companies that are authorised to do so. Moving up this stack, you've then got things like Creative Commons, CC share alike, non-commercial. So here we can say anyone meeting the conditions are sharing, we're happy to share data with. And then right at the other end of the spectrum, we've got open data. So the examples here, and this is, I quite often underestimate how misunderstood this spectrum is, particularly within our political sphere, within senior corporate leadership. You've got your corporate sensitive information here, your employee records. You've got the bus timetable. Right? These are quite different categories of information. The challenge here is working out how vague they are, because it's not, there aren't clear delineations across the spectrum. There are spreads of information, spreads of different kinds of licensing and different kinds of use cases. But when we think about this in terms of data eating the world, Andreessen said software was eating the world. Tim O'Reilly said we're entering a new world in which data may be more important than software. I'd argue we're already here, we've probably had been for quite some time. But what does that turn into when you think about data everywhere? So, state of the data as a data state. When we're producing data at an infrastructure level, our infrastructure has already turned into data. So whether that's our energy consumption, whether it's our transport data, whether it's the data you're missing from your mobile phone in your pocket, whether it's CCTV cameras on the street, or as I had recently, CCTV cameras in shop windows that shops are being paid to install in their shops so people do retail tracking in malls, with facial recognition, obviously, and with lots of other sentiment analysis and so on, through to maybe a bit higher, some altitude-based surveillance, going up to drones, going up to satellites. There's a fascinating company called Planet.com that I was overseeing in San Francisco about a month ago. This time next year, they'll have whole Earth observation at 2 meter resolution every 2 days. So we're getting towards Google Earth in real time. What are the implications when you match all of these different pieces together? So we talked a little bit about infrastructure and becoming data. One of the questions we're exploring with the ODI is, what if data is infrastructure itself? Well, when we pull all these things together, we need to ask different categories of question. Who owns the data? What's the governance structure? What are those use cases? How do we manage that data spectrum from closed to shared to open? There's another piece in this, which is Adam Smith's invisible hand. The collective action of many can have individual action can have impact on many people. And I wonder if there's also an invisible AI now that is complementary to this, where we're passing so much information through different systems. A lot of it is not controlled. A lot of it is messy. A lot of it is simply kind of noise, like the PDF I put up earlier, which has no context. But as we train our machines to understand the data patterns, what are the consequences of that? So when I think about data as infrastructure, I think we need to ask some really important questions. Linked with Martha's Dimbleby lecture and what Bill was saying, we've privatized the web, we're already working in a privatized space. There isn't really a public web, because all of it is owned by someone. There's always a transaction cost somewhere. And if you think about how can we create an equitable global society, if we follow the Silicon Valley business model, we don't end up anywhere near an equitable society. You end up amplifying the disconnect of mechanical surplus activity you have in developing economies. So how can we change that balance? And there's some fantastic work going on in developing economies to try and work out how to do things differently. But where's the digital public space in this? Should there be such a thing as a digital public space? Is there an equivalent of a park or a national park is an equivalent of the BBC. These are really questions we are not having a truly informed conversation about across the country and around the world. And I think when we look at this and the building blocks that are needed, I'm going to pick quite a tangential example here. If you think about land registries, we forget in the West that it's taken us hundreds of years to create land registries, but actually land registries are the basis of a lot of our economy. The fact that we stopped fighting over land and started transacting over land created an entire stability in our economic markets. If you look at countries like Peru, they're just going through this process. What's the equivalent question or set of questions in a digital space when we start talking about data? What's the equivalent of our electricity, or our water, or our land rights, when the web has a different physics to it? You can't just transpose the rules we have for the physical space into our digital economy. It doesn't respect country borders. When you copy something, you end up with two things. It's not the same as the raw material of oil or coal, where you use the material and it depletes. When you use the material, it increases in size. So the big question we're asking right now at the ODI is, who owns our data infrastructure? And we'd really like to hear your opinion on this. We'd like to hear questions, opinions, discussion. If you go to our website, it's on the front page. Please engage in this conversation. This is something that we're discussing. We raised at a conference last month in Ottawa with 1,000 policymakers around the world. The government and top-down approach to open data at country levels is not joined up with the private sector at all at the moment. And that those two pieces are not joined up with society and the kind of thing that Bill was talking about. We need to have this conversation. Excuse me. So I'm just going to finish off with a couple of things just about the ODI. I stood here a couple of years ago, the ODI was 6 months old. We have grown phenomenally in the last 2 years, and really shows the international appetite and interest around open right now, not just open data. People coming to this for everything to do with data, everything to do with anything that has open in the title. We've now got a team of 80 people, and we've reached over a million people. We've created over 10,000 data certificates. We've trained over 1,600 people, and we've got a global network now of over 300 organizations and individuals, including 25 startups and 20 franchises in 18 countries. Countries including Dubai, Queensland, South Korea, across Europe and South America. This is really a global initiative. And I really want to reflect, us all reflect, and we'll have time for questions around data, again, not just changing the nature of politics and business. This is a fundamental shift in our society to an open society. And one of the artwork city commissions last year of Weaning Us, I think, really exemplifies this. And I know everybody here is very committed to making democratic and open systems. We need to work on how to communicate that outside this building and outside this country. One final thing, just a little offer. You'll see postcards, everyone here. Yes, if you want to join the ODI, we're offering 50% off today. Just throw that into the next little sales pitch. But I want to finish on something that Buckminster Fuller once said, which is, let's build a world that works for everyone. Thank you very much.